Children have human rights. They're humans.
Every child's first hero is their caregiver.
You see it firsthand, and you really see and feel the impact, not just on the individual that you represent, but also their families and everyone else who gets left behind in their sphere.
We have chosen to support and pay for a system of punishment that causes these intergenerational harms on the children.
The best interests of the child shall be a primary consideration.
Hello, this is Michael Holland. I'm a lawyer at the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. I'm also on the board of Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. We call ourselves CIC. CIC researches and disseminates information for use by policymakers, legal professionals, and community representatives in the evidence-based creation of policies, laws, and programs supporting children impacted by caregiver incarceration. We're here today to do a podcast in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Human Rights Department that has been approved for continuing legal education credit to promote this mission. We're lucky today. We have Rebecca Schlafer with us. We're going to be talking about the impact of parental incarceration on children. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's wonderful. This should be a very exciting conversation with good information. Rebecca, could you do us a favor and introduce yourself to our audience today?
Sure. So my name is Rebecca Schlafer, and I am an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota's Medical School. And my background is in developmental child psychology, and I have additional training in maternal and child public health.
That's sounds like a lot of vowels and consonants at the end of your name, probably.
a lot of letters, sometimes with less expertise than I think I have.
I bet. How did you get involved in this field?
Yeah, I had a wonderful opportunity as an undergraduate research intern when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I was tasked with taking focus group notes, right? Listening to focus groups that were being facilitated by my mentor at the time. And I was asked to just take all the notes. And those were focus groups with grandparents who were raising their grandchildren. And I was really struck listening to those interviews as, you know, at that time, probably a 19-year-old, listening to stories about grandparents who are raising their grandchildren and some of the challenges that their own adult children were having, many of whom were cycling in and out of the criminal legal system. And I became very interested in the impact of parental incarceration on family systems. And that really launched the rest of my career.
Wow. And so you're at the University of Minnesota is what you said, correct?
Yep.
And what kind of work would that entail now?
Yeah. So I am primarily doing research. It depends on the semester, but mostly most of my time is spent conducting research on projects related to children and families affected by incarceration. And I also do some teaching. So I have a couple of classes that I teach depending on the year, one class called Mass Incarceration and Public Health, which is really focused on the health side of things, thinking about the health of folks who come into the criminal legal system, health services while people are incarcerated, and health when people get out. And I also teach another class called parental incarceration. I think that's what it might be called. Incarceration in the family. That's right. So I teach another class called Incarceration in the Family, and it really explores how what we know about parental incarceration and its association with children's well-being.
Wow. Is that undergrad or graduate school?
Yeah. So the Mass Incarceration and Public Health class, I've actually had the opportunity to teach sort of a hybrid model with both undergraduate and graduate students in the same class, which has been great. And then the Incarceration in the Family class is an undergraduate honor seminar.
Wow. So I went to the University of Minnesota for 10 years, 7 years of undergrad, 3 years of law. I think I still have some eligibility left. Can I sign up for these classes?
They're great classes, I have to say. And it's mostly because I've really worked hard to have currently impacted people join at every week. Before COVID, we used to go and tour several correctional facilities. So you're always welcome to come back as a guest, for sure.
And so that research that you're doing on parental incarceration,
You know, I'm sure there's some conclusions that you've drawn, and can you talk about a little bit how what the research shows that children are facing as far as harm when it comes to parental incarceration?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of my research recently, in the beginning, has been to really document the scope of this problem in our state, right? And I think that's one of the things that's been really lacking in the state of Minnesota, and acknowledging just how common this issue is. And what we know, right, is that actually many children in our state experience the incarceration of a parent. We used some data from the Minnesota Student Survey several years ago. That's a triennial survey of that survey includes 8th, 9th, and 11th graders, and we found that 1 in 6 Minnesota youth reports a history of parental incarceration. Now, that's not always prison, right? It might be jail, it might be for a short period of incarceration. But one of the things that I think my job has been as a researcher is really to document the scope of the problem. And again, if we have 1 in 6 Minnesota youth that are experiencing this, that have reported a history of parental incarceration, I think it begs the question, right? Like, well, what are their needs, right? What are some of the outcomes? And so after establishing some research on how many kids are impacted, and then a number of studies related to how many parents there are in Minnesota prisons and jails, we've also then worked to document some of their outcomes. And so I've done a series of studies, had an opportunity to use that Minnesota Student Survey again to look at youth's physical health outcomes, their educational outcomes, their use of substances. You know, the best part about the Minnesota Student Survey is that it asks a lot of questions about youth health and well-being, both risk and protective factors. And so we've been able to explore the outcomes of young people that report that they have a history of parental incarceration.
Wow. And so, and that data is something you're compiling and putting together and obtaining and showing that really the huge impact that incarceration will have on these children. So one of the things I've heard about are ACEs. Can you tell us what an ACE is and summarize what you've done on that?
Yeah, sure. So think about ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences. This is a set of experiences that are common that the original study asked adults to retrospectively report on a series of 10 experiences that they may have had before they turned 18. And these are things like being exposed to domestic violence, having a parent with a substance abuse issue, living with a member of your household who was incarcerated, et cetera. And what we know about ACEs is that they are common. Most people have experienced one or more ACEs. They are correlated, meaning that it's not uncommon that you might have a parent who has a substance abuse issue and that same parent or another parent has experienced their incarceration. And that they are correlated with long-term outcomes. So this is a cumulative risk model. And by that, we mean that the more adverse childhood experiences that you've had, the more likely you are to have a whole host of chronic and acute physical health issues in adulthood, as well as mental health issues and chemical dependency issues yourself in adulthood, right? So it's not really about one individual ACE. It is about the pileup of risk that we think about in childhood that leads to adversity throughout the early childhood period and confers risk to adult health broadly.
And it has an impact on both the mental health and the physical health of the child as they grow up, that those things, it manifests in that way. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right. I mean, I think we know that, you know, this dichotomy between physical and mental health is really a false dichotomy, and that we know that physical and mental health are connected in really important ways. And that this is true when we think about adversity in childhood and how it has lifelong consequences for, again, health broadly defined. One thing I want to point out is, right, so this adverse childhood experiences framework is helpful because Parental incarceration is an ACE, but there's also been some evidence to suggest that kids who have been exposed to this particular adverse childhood experience, the incarceration of a parent, are more likely than their peers who don't have an incarcerated parent to have more ACEs. So as I said earlier, ACEs are correlated with one another. And we know from some national data that kids who have experienced the incarceration of a parent have on average 4 more ACEs than their peers without an incarcerated parent. And so I always try to remind people that this is an ACE that sort of packs a lot of punch, in that when we think about what's driving mass incarceration in this country and what we think about would be a cause for someone to go to jail or prison in the first place, often it's other adversities in that family environment, right? So a parent with a chemical health problem, a parent with a profound, serious, persistent mental illness, domestic violence, those are all separate ACEs. And we know that they're connected to incarceration in many cases.
And so that piece may, it sounds like, compound the other ACEs that may be existing in that child's life.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what's so hard about parental incarceration, is that the science on this, some of the science has tried to like isolate the impact of parental incarceration, right? Like just the parent's incarceration. But really, this is a constellation of risk often for many families. And it's not just the incarceration, right? It's the child's exposure to domestic violence before dad went to prison. It's the exposure to mom's persistent heroin use and her unavailability as a parent, right? And what that means for the attachment and bonding in the parent-child relationship. And it's not necessarily just the separation because of incarceration. It is the environment and the context and the developmental course that happened before a period of incarceration that also matters. And so scientifically, right, teasing apart what's the criminal legal system piece and what's all the other stuff is complicated. And I'm not always sure that scientifically that's an important question to ask, right? Like, well, does parental incarceration cause X, Y, or Z? Well, parental incarceration is complex. And I think that's what we need to really be focusing on. And in some ways, I think that gives judges and lawyers a bigger picture from which to draw on when thinking about how do we help this family? Because it's not just let's get this parent out of jail or let's get this parent home from prison, but all of the other contextual pieces that perhaps put that parent at risk for incarceration in the first place.
I see. Now, and one thing you and I talked about before doing this is what I do. I'm a public defender, and I represent right now children in juvenile court, but I've represented adults as well for the last 25 years. And a lot of what we talk about, or at least the justice system, is how parental incarceration feeds upon itself and recidivism and things like that. But is there a connection between parental incarceration and a child's involvement with the criminal legal system?
Yeah, I love that question, because people have answered it lots of different ways, and depending on which evidence you pick, there is some evidence, right, that kids with an incarcerated parent have higher likelihood of juvenile delinquency and other issues. However, right, as we've just talked about, we know that kids with incarcerated parents also have more adversity in their lives, which is also correlated with their own justice involvement. So I think about, right, these are families that are more likely to be poor. These are families that are more likely to have a parent with limited education. They may be homeless or highly mobile. All of these things also increase a young person's risk for delinquency, for truancy, for school disengagement, and those kinds of things. And so the science here is not as clear as some have claimed in terms of this direct link between parental incarceration and the next generation's incarceration. Okay. That said, when we ask retrospectively, among currently incarcerated people, when we ask them to reflect on their parents' involvement in the criminal legal system, we know that many people who are incarcerated have a family history of engagement in the criminal legal system. And I would just say that that is probably less about individual characteristics and far more likely to be the structural and institutional things that are built into who gets caught up in our criminal legal system and how that is perpetuated across generations.
You know, that's not to say that certain people are more predisposed or, you know, genetically, you know.
Correct.
You know, it's more of the institutional and structural framework that's surrounding our criminal justice system. Is that right?
Well, and it comes back to those ACEs, right? So when we know that when we have more ACEs, when we are exposed to more adversity in childhood during this period of the life course where we're growing into adults, right? When kids have more adversity in childhood, they're more likely to have the very problems that put them at risk for engagement in the criminal legal system, right? So they might have more behavior problems, more physical fighting with their peers, et cetera. And that could put them at increased risk, but it is not deterministic in the sense that, yes, you've had your parent that is incarcerated and you're going to jail or prison too. And in fact, I think the strongest evidence for this, right, is the fact that we know that there are millions of kids who have incarcerated parents who don't go on to be involved in the criminal legal system themselves. And I think that's an important piece of the science here where we really need to understand what helps protect kids from these adverse outcomes.
Oh, okay. You know, one of the things that, you know, it seems obvious to me at times working in the industry field of justice, I guess, is that when you incarcerate a parent, there may be significant economic impacts to that family. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, gosh, I just had a case like this not all that long ago. I should have said in my introduction that I also served as a guardian ad litem for about 10 years in the 4th Judicial District. And, you know, through that work, have had a lot of opportunities to see families that were not just involved in the child welfare system, but also whose parents had a history of involvement in the criminal legal system or were currently incarcerated or were facing incarceration. And, you know, so often many families that are involved in the criminal legal system are already impoverished, right, or disenfranchised financially. And we talked about that a minute ago in terms of they may have unstable housing or have, you know, prior periods of incarceration that make them make it challenging to access employment or steady employment. But it's also true that incarceration in and of itself can lead to economic instability. So you think for a second about a case in which, you know, dad is dealing drugs. Well, often that drug dealing, right, is bringing in some economic resources to the family system. And when dad becomes incarcerated, the finances that were coming in from, yes, that illegal activity, but also supporting, you know, the paying the rent, buying food can really be disruptive for the family system and the child well-being. We also know that in many cases there may be, you know, supports, government assistance, for example, families that are receiving WIC or food stamps. When that parent becomes incarcerated, there can be a disruption in the supports that family is receiving, and that can be really devastating for families as well. And I can think about a case that I just had as a guardian ad litem where I will say it really challenged my thinking on this topic. So without going into too many details, I will say that it was, you know, a case of sexual abuse among a teenage, one of the children in the family had been sexually abused by her father. Father was looking at and took a plea and got a long criminal sentence. I want to say like maybe 15 years. And he was the primary and only breadwinner for that family. He was the only one who was working. Biological mom was not working at the time. And all of the family's benefits were tied up with dad. And so what was really complicated for that family was when dad went to prison, literally every financial support was stopped, right? The family was looking at losing their home. Mom had no work history to contribute. And even if she was able to quickly get a job, there was no way that they were going to be able to continue to afford the home that they were living in. The children's health insurance benefits, the mom's health insurance benefits were all tied to dad's employment. Dad's, you know, retirement benefits and any of that was also there. So it was a case in which was the incarceration of the father in the child's best interest? I think I can confidently say yes, right? That dad had no business abusing his child, sexually abusing his child in the way that he was. It was horrific. And there were still negative consequences of his incarceration, right? So while it was a good thing that dad, as the perpetrator, was removed from that home, it was also, there were collateral consequences for that child and the family that really challenged my thinking about, is incarceration the right thing here?
Right. And that I could see that being a tough set of circumstances. And that's not that unusual where the effect on the victim can be greater by the justice system's involvement sometimes. So yeah, I can see that happening. That's a tough set of facts right there.
And I think in that case in particular, what was really challenging, right, was like, imagine for a young person who is now, you know, the facts of the case were clear. Had he sexually abused his daughter? Yes. Was it horrific? Yes. Was she old enough to talk about that? Absolutely. And she was old enough to feel the guilt around her family almost losing their home and the stress that was on her mom and the challenges that she felt about disclosing what she did and how the case came out. And, you know, I think it was a lot to lay on a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah. Oof. A lot to lay on anyone. All right. That brings me to a question about education. And is there any research out there that talks about how parental incarceration affects, you know, what levels of education are attained by the child?
Yeah, so there is a growing body of evidence looking at different effects of parental incarceration on things like school readiness, educational outcomes like attendance and grades and school engagement. We've done some of that work here in Minnesota. It's really interesting. We looked at school outcomes, so teacher-child connectedness, engagement, attendance, grades, I think maybe one other outcome. And we looked at it using the Minnesota Student Survey across three different school settings. So kids in public schools, kids in alternative learning centers, and kids in juvenile correctional facilities. And what was really interesting about that study was that we found for the kids in public school, that parental incarceration was a very strong predictor of poor school outcomes. It was less so for kids in alternative learning centers. And it was not a significant predictor of poor educational outcomes for kids in the juvenile correctional facilities. And we, you know, really thought a lot about why that may be. And it's not surprising in the context of the conversation we were just having that those kids in the juvenile correctional facilities have already experienced a tremendous amount of adversity, right? They were more likely to be living in poverty, they were more likely to have experienced parent with substance abuse issues. They had already experienced more adversity than their public school peers. And the parents' incarceration was one of many risks that they had experienced. In and of itself, controlling for those other factors was not a predictor of poor outcomes. But for most kids in public schools, we see strong negative effects between parental incarceration and a number of education-related outcomes.
Okay, thank you. So we're here in Minnesota, and one of the things I've noticed about Minnesota is that we do that one of us thing, and how does it affect Minnesota? Can you break down how Minnesota fits in the national context of parental incarceration and its effects on children?
Sure. So I would say that until we did some of the research that we did in Minnesota, Minnesota was not unlike other states in which we had no idea how many kids in our state were impacted by parental incarceration. And our state is not unlike others in that we don't systematically collect this information from people who are incarcerated. And so what's been really hard for many, many years was, you know, drawing out this issue as an important one in our context, right? And so my colleagues and I, in partnership with the Department of Corrections in 2014, had an opportunity to survey people who were in state prisons. And then a couple years later, we surveyed people who were in county jails all across the state. And what I can tell you is that in Minnesota, about two-thirds of incarcerated men are parents with minor children, and more than half of them were living with one or more of their children prior to arrest. And I'll stop right there and just say that, you know, I think often people make the incorrect assumption that incarcerated fathers were not involved in their children's lives or were not a part of their kids' lives. And these data suggest that that's not the case, right? That for 56% of incarcerated fathers, they were living with one or more of their children prior to their arrest. And that in and of itself is a disruption to the family system. We also know that the majority of women in prison are mothers with minor children. So about 77% of women in prison are mothers with minor children, and two-thirds of them report that they were living with one or more of their children prior to arrest. So this is not a small issue in our state. You know, it's estimated, in 2014, we estimated that about 16,000 Minnesota youth, children of any age, about 16,000 Minnesota kids had a parent currently in prison. And we've estimated some similar numbers for parents in jails. And I'd be happy to share those resources with your listeners if that would be interesting to folks.
Yeah. Well, so wait a minute. So you're saying 16,000 children had a parent in prison. And is it another 16,000 that had a parent in jail?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So when we estimated, based on the prison study, we estimated 16,000 kids had a parent currently in prison. And we did a very similar study with a point in time estimate, meaning we attempted to survey everybody who was sitting in county jail on a single day. And we estimated from those data that about another 10,000 kids have a parent in jail. Now, those are moving targets, right? Because jails turn over very, very fast. So we attempted to survey, right, on a single day, all of the people who were in jails. I think we did a pretty good job on that, but the estimates from that were about 10,000 kids with a parent in jail.
And just for our listeners' sake, prison is a state penitentiary, a year and a day or more. And a jail is a local jail, or the workhouse, some people would call it, which would be less than a year and a day.
Or pretrial, right? I think that's another important piece of this. People who get picked up and can't get out, but are staying in jail until they post bail.
Right. Which, and sometimes those bails, I'm speaking from experience, sometimes the bail is $50 and they can't come up with it.
And I think it's important. That's exactly right. And it still has implications for children and families, right? Even a short period of incarceration could result in the parent losing their job, losing their health insurance, have financial implications in order to come up with that bail, regardless of cost, right? And so all of that can then have, even a short period of incarceration, even if it doesn't lead to a criminal conviction, can be destabilizing for the family system.
Yeah, and one of the things I've seen a couple times too is not only the jobs and you know, just the financial situation, but the housing piece, if they're in some sort of public housing, if that incarceration is more than, I want to say it's 30 days, you might lose your public housing depending on certain factors. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think housing is such an you know, intricately linked issue here, right? We know that people who are unhoused or instably housed are more visible to police and therefore might be more likely to be picked up and involved, kind of wrapped back up into the criminal legal system. And then on the back end, we know that there are barriers to getting housing depending on a felony conviction, as well as any short period of incarceration, like you said, losing access to public housing. you know, this is not unlike the conversation that's being had around public health insurance, right? Because technically, when somebody is incarcerated, the federal inmate exclusion policy means that they cannot be on their Medicaid at that time. And some counties terminate rather than suspend Medicaid enrollment. And if kids are tied to parents or other benefits, that parents' incarceration can result in the health insurance. Kids are still eligible, but again, that eligibility and the enrollment may be tied to the now incarcerated parent who is ineligible. And I think that's, again, sort of these collateral consequences that we don't fully appreciate how destabilizing they are to family systems.
Okay. So judges are the ones who typically, I can't imagine a situation where they don't, but a judge is the one sending people to prison, usually at the request of the state. So practically speaking, how should a judge think about these things? What would make sense for a judge to think about when they're giving a sentence off to somebody who's allegedly committed a crime?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it depends on a lot of factors. And I think that's the thing that makes this complicated, right? Is that when I'm thinking about whether or not a parent needs to be incarcerated, it's not just there is clearly, right, a threat to public safety. 100%. We can't ignore the fact that there needs to be a conversation about, you know, what is the crime and is this person somebody that is a threat to public safety? And yet at the same time, we also know that there are alternatives to incarceration and that depending on the money in your pocket and the color of your skin, your experience in that criminal legal system and your sentence might look quite different, right? And I think this is really an important piece. We know that judges do have considerable discretion in thinking about what a criminal sentence will look like. And I would encourage judges to think about, okay, what are the potential collateral consequences of this for children and families? And factors that I think judges should be considering primarily are how much is this parent's incarceration going to be a disruption for the child well-being, right? If this parent was a primary caregiver for the child and was the primary person who was doing the day-to-day care for the kids, that's going to be incredibly disrupting to the family relationship and to children's well-being. It's not just that, right? It is there another parent at the home that was also providing care? What are the opportunities for alternative caregivers? How old is the child? How long will the parent be incarcerated and where will the parent be incarcerated? Is there any opportunity to maintain a family relationship during this period of incarceration? You know, it's not always appropriate for parents to stay with children. And I think that's important to remember too, right? I go back to that case of sexual abuse and I still don't know the right outcome there, right? I mean, do we allow under any circumstance a father who is perpetrating sexual violence on his daughter to remain in that home? I think the answer is no. And yet how do we identify ways that we reduce the harm that is caused by that period of incarceration? I think about issues of domestic violence, right? Where kids are being exposed to considerable violence in the home and removal of that perpetrator is essential to the safety of the other person, the other parent, and in many cases, the children. And yet, again, it's not just always as easy as, well, this is the crime, you're going to prison. It is a really, I think, a complicated calculation around the caregiving responsibility and relationship with the child, how long the parent will be gone, a number of pre-existing risk factors that we've talked about already. And I think that makes it complicated.
That makes a lot of sense, and especially when you mentioned domestic violence, that there's some work that's been done that shows that how it's cyclical and how that, you know, observing domestic violence in the home, it's more likely that that person, the child, will then domestically, you know, violate their spouse or loved one at some point. So yeah, it's something that the courts have to consider, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's That's exactly right in terms of what are we exposing kids to and the adversity. And again, it's not just the incarceration, right? A mom who has a profound substance abuse issue is not providing often the kind of home and environment that that child needs to thrive. And yet I would question, is an incarceration, a period of incarceration, going to change that child's circumstances, right? For many children, that will not lead to a better circumstance. It might involve, you know, moving caregivers multiple times. It might involve, you know, being placed through foster care, et cetera. And I think more often we need to question, what is the root of the issues that the parent is facing? And is there intervention to support that parent's needs, right? Mom needs support getting sober. Mom needs support so she can be fully present and emotionally available for her children. Incarceration isn't going to fix those problems.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the lawyers. It's always about me. I'm just kidding. But, you know, as a lawyer, you know, I know that there's certain things that I try to do and try to convince the judges. You know, what do you recommend lawyers do to present these considerations to the court?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I would be thinking about, and I guess in criminal court, especially, thinking about whether or not there are alternatives, right? Again, what are the collateral consequences to this period of incarceration? And can mom's needs be met in a different way? Or can dad's needs be met in a different way? Are there alternatives? Is there a period of probation that would allow these families to stay together? Are there services? When incarceration is necessary, what are we going to do to support relationships between children and families? And again, sometimes that separation is going to happen. And then I think it's a question of how do we support the family when a separation happens? How do we make sure that kids are getting therapy for that loss, right? There is a grief and loss that happens when a parent becomes incarcerated. How do they make sense of that experience? They might have a disruption in their home environment with their caregivers. They may have to change schools. So providing support for kids on that end, I think, is really important. And really thinking about, okay, what are the impacts of this incarceration on children? I think lawyers can do a lot to advocate for their client about alternatives, but also what their client and their client's families may need if and when an incarceration has to happen.
Now, I'm seeing, is there an opportunity here where at a sentencing hearing, a lawyer could call an expert per se to talk about what these various impacts and collateral consequences could be. And so they're educating the judge through the expert testimony of a witness.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I've had the opportunity to be an expert witness on a couple of capital cases in another state where I was brought in at the mitigation stage. To really talk about what a death penalty would mean for a parent. In that case, a parent who was very young at the time that the criminal case had opened and girlfriend was pregnant, and this dad had maintained an incredible relationship throughout his period of incarceration leading up to this criminal sentencing. And you know, that was an interesting case in the sense that, well, one, thankfully, we don't have to worry about the capital cases here in Minnesota. But two, thinking about how do I help this judge understand that even if this dad has a very long sentence, right, a sentence of life instead of a sentence of a death penalty, that he could still have a relationship with his children. So that's probably a unique situation in which experts have been brought in. But I do think that expert witnesses can help judges understand the consequences of an incarceration on children. I think that, I also think that in some cases in which, you know, social workers may be involved or other experts in the court can do a lot to educate judges and lawyers too about the way this period of incarceration could impact children.
I think, you know, it dawns on me is that perhaps, you know, universities are probably a good place to look for experts who are studying these things. Are there other people throughout the country who study these things like you're studying?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly experts most often use, right, in thinking about cases in which juveniles are convicted and thinking about adolescent brain development and adolescent history of trauma. And I think in those cases, right, thinking about, I think about my colleagues who do work on the juvenile life without parole set, juvenile life without parole work. I mean, that I think is where we've seen a lot of experts come in and talk about, listen, the adolescent brain is different, right? And that's where a developmental psychologist, I do think, can come in handy and think about helping judges understand development broadly, but also can help judges understand adversity and trauma and toxic stress and how that contributes to what one may see as quote unquote criminal behavior.
That's fascinating. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here together. What I'd like to know, though, is what's next? What's the latest in the research field that you're working on?
Gosh, that's a great question. So we have been working really hard over the last 10 years documenting the needs of pregnant and postpartum people in our women's prison, as I shared. And probably the most exciting thing that's happening right now is a conversation that's happening right now in real time at the state legislature about alternatives to incarceration for pregnant people. And the idea would be that the Commissioner of Corrections could have those women carry out their sentences in community alternatives to incarceration. And I think probably we need to better understand how that's going to unfold, what their needs are in the community, and how we can support alternatives for pregnant people so that we don't have any more pregnant people in prison. And to me, I think that's a really exciting next step. We know a number of programs across the country that are starting to provide group-based parenting education and birth support to pregnant and postpartum women in prison. And so I'll be doing a lot of work probably over the next 5 to 10 plus years on what the needs are of that unique population.
Great. You know, I think that's probably the end of our time. It's been such a fascinating conversation. I will add to that last thought of yours that parental education could be a portion of what, you know, happens in prison and trying to keep that family together and visits and having there not be such an estrangement. That seems like it could work too. But I do want to thank you for your time. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I want to say, keep up the great work that you're doing in research and educating us all. And you're doing a great service for the state of Minnesota. So we really appreciate that.
Thanks. It was really nice to have this conversation today. We touched on a lot of stuff, and I really appreciate you taking the time to have the conversation.
All right. Well, take care, Rebecca.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you for listening to this Continuing Legal Education podcast hosted by me, Michael Holland, with Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. Our episodes contain original music by David Smith, our podcast producer. If you intend to request credit for this CLE and any of our other installments, please enter your name and contact information at the link in the description. You can find more about our organization and access the materials that correspond to these episodes, including federal and state sentencing checklists, online at cicmn.org.